Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Tuesday, January 30th, 2024. It means it's time for another hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. So I'm joined by my really good friend, Terry Fletcher. And oh, by the way, today, happy birthday to my now 83-year-old mother who lives in Boca Raton, Florida. Enjoy your day. All right. I did my job as a son. Let's jump in, Terry. And for those of you that are like, wow, that's so mean. I went on to Amazon. I typed in the search function, gifts for mother, and a bunch of stuff came up. And I chose something that I thought she would like because she's elderly and she's always complaining about her legs. So I got her these things that you stick your feet and legs into. They have Velcro and it has a remote and you turn it on and it massages your legs and it makes you feel better. And then I sent her dinner for tonight. So before you think I'm mean, I actually got her a nicer gift than she's ever gotten me.
Well, yeah, at least you don't have a daughter, maybe you do, that does what mine does. So this morning at 5:55 a.m. I get this call and she's like, I think I had food poisoning all night long, and she's crying on the phone, and I'm like, oh, okay. And she's like, I go, well, have you had it since 2 a.m.? She's like, no, it's a little better. I'm like, okay, well, get ready for work. She's a school teacher and 28 years old. She's not 12. And I'm just like, and then she goes, oh, I already called in. And I'm like, well, then why are you calling me? I'm sleeping. You are an hour ahead of me in Arizona summer. What are you doing?
Kids.
My mommy make me feel better. I'm like, I'm going back to sleep for my 40 minutes before I have to get up. I'm just seriously? Oh, my God.
If you were six, mommy would make you feel better. You're 28. Grow up. Be an adult and go to work.
Her husband is next to her. I'm like, tell Christian.
Excuse me. This is a big week for me.
Yeah.
I get to finally have my right eye fixed.
Oh, good.
I had my left eye fixed in December. It was life-changing for me, and I have been counting down the days. With it being Tuesday, I had to start my drops in my right eye 2 days before the procedure, and I don't know what they are, but they have a tan top on them, and they sting, and I have to put them in 4 times a day. And but you know what? I can deal with it. You know, the prep when you get to the surgery center for the eye surgery is 24 drops in the eye spread out over like 30 minutes. So it's really, for somebody like me with anxiety, it's kind of like, but it's like I've told myself, you know, a dozen times, suck it up, buttercup, because you'll be able to see like an 18-year-old who doesn't have eye problems.
That's so the procedure.
All right. So speaking of procedures and services, we're going to talk about something today that Terry and I both dread talking about, but we have to talk about it because so many of the cases that I get retained on for both the government and for defense counsel, and the audits that Terry does both for providers and payers involves this specific topic extensively, excuse me. So Terry, I'm going to let you kick the conversation off and let's see where it goes.
So our topic today is incident 2. I know you've heard us talk about this before. We do bring it up from time to time, but we have to talk about it because when it's always in the forefront, it's always something that people are thinking about. you know, remember, this is about where your physician is immediately available for direct supervision. They have to be there. They have to initiate care. They don't have to be in the same room as the patient, but they do have to and also show a participation in that ongoing care for the patient. The one reason we wanted to bring it up is we had a little caveat during the public health emergency. And I don't know about Sean, but I actually didn't know until about a year in when somebody said, hey, we're doing what they allowed us to do for virtual supervision. I'm like, what are you talking about? And I mean, I know telehealth like the back of my hand, and I must have missed that. And then all of a sudden I see people doing this virtual supervision, which, Sean, to me, that just looks like they've got a, you know, like an R2-D2 C-3PO running around the office with an iPad. Remember Max Headroom, you know, just like this.
Oh yeah. Talking head.
The doctor's head. And so I asked a couple of my clients, how are you handling this? They're like, well, we tried to tell the doctors that we were pretending it didn't exist because they didn't want to deal with it either. So what the temporary exception allowed was the immediate availability for direct supervision through virtual presence, which facilitates the provision of that telehealth service by clinical staff of physicians. And so it is supposed to end at the end of the year that the PHE ended. And then, of course, they came out, Medicare, CMS, because people were whining about it, came out and said, well, we'll go ahead and extend it through 2024. But the thing you have to realize is the reason that they aren't making it permanent is because they're trying to figure out whether or not it is safe. And they said, you know, we're trying to figure out to determine if it's safe, if it is, you know, what's the benefit versus, you know, the access. So they said with this flexibility, physicians and non-physician practitioners, yes, you've been able to remotely supervise services furnished in places where in-person supervision may not be feasible, such as the patient's home and possibly satellite locations. And I like this for the staffing shortage, not necessarily, you know, COVID-19 or anything. But what I don't like about it is the fact that I think people are defaulting to it and the doctors are on vacation.
Well, people are always defaulting to this stuff.
It's crazy to me. They're not using it in the spirit of which it was used. And I hate to say that because everybody's like, well, if I can do it, I can do it. I'm like, okay, but Sean and I have both seen Sean on the defense side and myself on the, you know, the payer, give me money back side. That first of all, they say, well, why are you doing that if you don't have to anymore? So, you know, if everyone's back to the office and everyone, you know, and you've got the safeguards in place that they talk about, whether it be vaccines, whether it be masks, whatever you're comfortable doing, whatever the OSHA requirement is for your, you know, state and your area, then, you know, using this virtual presence as far as incident two, I have a problem with that, the supervision part of it, because it really, to me, is opening up Pandora's box. Because Sean, how are you immediately available? Immediately available by, you know, video? I mean, to me, that's a safety issue.
Well, yeah. I mean, listen, immediate availability. The problem that we have, Terry, is the ambiguity in the guidelines. And I think that's done purposefully because it allows the government and prosecutors, investigators to create a narrative to fit a potential violation. Said this for years. I say it in court all the time.
Well, you actually just brought up a point because as I was researching this, one thing I did notice is that Medicare has not updated the Medicare manual on this. They have not updated it for virtual. Only the Medicare fee schedule final rule had a payment policy in there. And they said it's not permanent. They still say it's temporary because they have to figure out how to balance patient safety, quality, and integrity concerns. But the other thing that they were talking about as well is that there's no guidance to talk about how to document it. They suggest, you know, that auxiliary personnel can note their identity and credentials of the supervising physician or provider, you know, in the note. But there's nothing that says that this is what you have to do. Which, again, I mean, like,
and I think that's by design. I do.
Provided risk.
Yeah, I think it's by design. And listen, I think there's what I always refer to as best practices, right? And best practice doesn't mean that it's a statute, act, law, regulation. It just simply means it's a recommendation. It's a best practice. It's something that we make as a recommendation in the absence of clear and decisive, definitive guidance from a payer.
And I've seen your, I've seen a couple of your court cases where I've read some of the narrative on it that's been online. And, you know, people, you have to understand how just how challenging some of the things that Sean has to help defend with an attorney and everything. But I'm so impressed by how you have used the best practice in a way to defend physicians saying, look, we don't have any guidance. So the doctor is using the best tool he can with what's available and saying, this is what the best practice is. And it is a conservative approach. And I'm all in on that. To make sure that, you know, you're not stepping outside those lines, you know, the rule of stay in your lane. We're not saying that you should not do something or not use this virtual presence. We're saying that when is it appropriate? Like in teaching facilities, I think it can be appropriate because doctors are pulled and again, staff shortages.
Certainly.
But in the non-facility setting, I'm having a hard time with it. And just to kind of back up and reiterate what Incident 2 services are, it means you're getting 100% reimbursed for doing something, billing under the physician who, again, is supposed to be in the office but isn't necessarily seeing the patient. So once we jump to virtual, the doctor's not even there. And you're trying to get paid for something that says that they're immediately available and within yelling distance. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, this is where we've got a gray area on patient safety. And so back to your point, Sean, how would you document that from a best practices, if the doctor, let's say, has decided to do virtual supervision from their home and they haven't come in back in the office yet, but their home is, you know, 20 miles from the office?
Yeah. Well, I think here's the first thing that you have to think about. Okay. One, the 1135 waivers, for the most part, are gone, with the exception of a few of them that have been extended through 2024, right? Incident 2 is not one of those, meaning general supervision outside of the office, meaning available by telephone or email or other electronic communicate. It's not there. Then, 2, you have to go and look at the guidelines for Incident 2. And it says the physician is not required to be in the same room at the time the services are rendered, but they have to be on the premises. They have to be in the same office suite. Okay. It doesn't mean that you have a computer monitor, to use Terry's analysis or analogy of Max Headroom, you know, where you have a talking head inside of a box that's located in the office suite and the doctor's, you know, sitting at home on a couch eating bonbons, watching All My Children from 20 miles away. Doesn't work that way. That's not Incident 2 guidelines.
But the virtual supervision now says that through the end of 2024, it says that they can say that they're immediately available via real time through audio and video technology. Yeah. But it just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I get that. But here's what I would say, okay? If you're part of a physician-directed group, okay, and a physician-directed group means that there are two or more physicians in the group, and at any given time, a physician who's not simply there for administrative purposes, who's actually there for clinical purposes, working, can actually be the supervising physician, even though the services are being billed under the physician of record. Now, there's got to be clear documentation. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm talking about chapter 15 of the Medicare program and the Medicare benefit policy manual. And I think it's 60.1 through 60.9 is the section that we're
talking about. You are correct. You are correct.
Good. Thank you. Here's what I would say for a best practice, right? Something that I would feel comfortable and confident sitting in front of a jury, or even prior to it going to a jury, writing an expert disclosure or a report that goes to the prosecutor in the case at DOJ for a proffer, right? That states something to the effect of, while the physician of record was immediately available through electronic communication as per the published guidance from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and accepted or published by the American Medical Association, whatever it is, okay? There is also a supervising physician on the premises as part of a physician-directed clinic. I have had to make that argument in, God, I can't even tell you how many court cases. I could tell you in at least three or four court cases last year that resulted in acquittal, where the government didn't even recognize that there was something called a physician-directed clinic, which really is troubling to me for other reasons, but I'll withhold my comments on that. Again, you can have a physician who is not the initial treating physician acting as a supervising physician for an NP or a PA who is carrying out an existing plan of care for a patient, even though the initiating physician is not in the office. It's written in the guidelines. It's written in Chapter 15, Section 60.1 through 60.9 of the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual. Excuse me. So, again, I think there's two things that I would say. One, you've got to have a clear policy that clearly says, in the absence of the initiating physician of care for a patient, any physician that's part of the physician-directed group can engage on behalf of the PA or NP rendering the services. But let me pause there because, you know, Terry, you know, I want to get your take on a couple of these things too.
So one of the things that I also wanted to bring up, and this happens quite a bit, moving away a little bit from the virtual, and then we'll come back to that because I sent you something from the Social Security Act and the Federal Register. But one of the things that I think is kind of missed sometimes when it comes to incident two. So let's say that a patient is initiated for hypertension and for cholesterol, et cetera, and they're coming in, new patient, they've seen the physician, so now they're coming back in and as an established patient, and they're seeing the nurse practitioner. The nurse practitioner under incident two can carry out whatever the physician has documented as now this treatment plan for the patient. And the doctor has to see them periodically or participate in the ongoing care. There's no frequency guideline for that. So again, we're back to best practices of what that looks like. I recommend at least every 6 months they should follow up with the physician, but some people say that every year. It just depends on the status of those chronic conditions. But let's just say that the medication that the doctor prescribed wasn't working, the patient was still having spikes in their hypertension, was still high. So without consulting the physician, the nurse practitioner basically changed the medication, changed the protocol, changed the dosage, and then sent the patient on their way, and they're coming back in a little sooner to see how it's going, and told them to take some reads at home. That's not incident two. That's billed out under the nurse practitioner. But let me take it a step further. Let's say at that initial visit, doctor prescribed medication for that hypertension, said, you know, we're going to try this. And when you come back in, and you probably will see my nurse practitioner on the next visit, if we need to make an adjustment in medication, she's going to go ahead and do that. And then we'll monitor you from there. So now the patient comes back in for an established visit and they need to make an adjustment with the same medication, maybe higher the dosage or lower the dosage and, or even change it. If that's what was in the record, is that incident two? Yes, it is. So it's really following the instructions of the physician straight across the board without taking on the patient yourself as a nurse practitioner or PA. It's not that they can't, they can, but for those of you that think that, you know, RAC audits are gone, they're not. This is one of the number one things they look at under RAC audits, is that you have to have, and lack of a better way to put it, incident two policing in your office, because You've got to have a physician, and I like how Sean put it, you've got to have the, you know, I'd like to call it the doctor of the day, whoever's on rotation to be that supervising physician. you've got to document fully and understand. I would put why you don't have a doctor there if you're doing it virtually. If that doctor's on vacation, we don't recommend you do that. That's just, to me, that's not the rule. It means that because they said it right in the rule that it means the physician wasn't able to be there. It doesn't mean that they weren't able to be there because they went on vacation instead. It's what they weren't able to be. Maybe they're in surgery, maybe they're somewhere where they have to see, you know, other patients at another facility and they have a staff shortage. So this was how they had to do it because the patient couldn't come in. There has to be extenuating circumstances clinically that make sense. Okay. Not because it's, you know, convenient.
See, while I agree with you, I think what the government did was they created a mousetrap. Okay.
Oh, big time.
I agree with you. But when you have somebody like myself whose job is to look at the guidelines and to identify all the ambiguity and all the, you know, the malfeasance with the people who wrote this stuff, I look at this and I say, listen, what's the difference between a physician in this situation? This is just me talking, right? What's the difference between a physician who is making rounds at the hospital and is not available to be in the clinic today, but we have another physician there as part of the physician-directed clinic, versus Dr. Weiss was out of the country today. The virtual supervision, direct supervision guidelines don't state that you can't be out of the country. You can't be, you know, on vacation. I think out of the country is a stretch. I do.
You can't be out of the country.
But okay, so the doctor's on
because
a hunting
you're billing
trip.
Because you're billing under the doctor and they can't bill for out of country services.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. I agree 100%. That's why I caught myself and I stopped. But Dr. Weiss is out of the state right now in Arkansas, but you know, because he's on a duck hunt. But you know, he's got his mobile phone and he's got a secure link to be able to, you know, call in for a virtual appointment if necessary, so he's immediately available. I guess me as a defense person for probably 80% of the cases that I do, I think I would argue if the government intended for them not to be on vacation, they would have said that in the guidelines. But there's flexibility, you know, I think it leaves it open to interpretation. And that's where writing your own policy is so important.
And I agree to a point on that. But then I look back at what I sent you, which comes from the 42 CFR.
Yeah, I'm reading
410. Well. And the very bottom of it is words and language from CMS where it says CMS considers the future of virtual direct supervision. This is the part that I'm thinking they're going to get us. A task it frames as balancing patient safety, quality, and program integrity concerns with the interest of supporting expanded access to care and preserving workforce capacity for medical professionals. So to me, they're trying to make sure the patient has access. They're concerned about safety and quality and program integrity, and obviously the workforce shortage that we've had. So to me, the example we give of the physician going on vacation doesn't speak to that. It doesn't allow for the safety concerns. It's like, well, if you were so concerned about your patients, then why didn't you have a covering physician? Why didn't somebody in your office, you know? And right, so to me, right. I think that there's a gray area there. There is a little bit of
a gray there's area. Definitely a gray area. And I think that's where juries come into play. Yeah. And you hope that reasonable persons can look at this and say, well, if that's what you meant, you should have written it that way. I mean, that's always, you know, one of my counter punches when a prosecutor starts reading something to me. And, you know, listen, I try to explain to people all the time, the purpose of an attorney is to tell a story. Okay. Yeah. They're either telling a story of something you did wrong or telling a story of why what you did wasn't wrong. And then experts, unless something is definitive, right? Even things that are scientific, in the scientific community, you're still going to have those who disagree, whatever, right? You know, it's like I tell everybody, opinions are like buttholes. Everybody has one. It's who's more compelling, who has better character, who's a better storyteller, who connects better with the jury, you know, whatever. But that's one of the counterpunches that I, you know, when I hear prosecutors start to ask me questions and I wait, you know, obviously to see if there's an objection to form or if there's another objection or whatever it is. And then I begin my answer by saying, well, what you just said is not actually a direct quote from the program integrity manual or from the Medicare benefit policy manual or from an NCD or an LCD. You just paraphrased it and you gave me your opinion. Okay. Or you added words that aren't in there. Let's go and pull up the actual citation and the actual section. And then we read it. And, you know, I very gently point out the absence of the words that the prosecutor just used in questioning me. Now, sometimes I get away with it. Sometimes I don't. And it's up to defense counsel on redirect to make sure they were paying attention to the little things that I've done on the stand. But, you know, I always punch back.
And that's your job. And I totally get that. Yeah, that's your job. So then.
But remember, Terry, I'm not doing something because I'm looking for a loophole. I'm doing something because it's not there the way that they are posing it.
But remember, you already have the doctor that's in trouble. I have the doctor that isn't in trouble. So
I don't want the doctors.
I know, but that's what you get. I get the doctors who are not in trouble and saying, well, technically, and so, okay. So now I'm going to play advocate on the other side. Yeah. And this is why we work is because now for me, let's say I'm that pain in the butt juror and I'm saying, okay, wait a minute. So first of all, the one thing that says here is the reason it was extended, if we're reading this in, you know, real time, because this is language right out of the CFR and out of CMS's conversation. Right. They're saying the reason they even extended it is because they're allowing this to allowing this virtual direct supervision to allow them to study it. They're saying while CMS considers the future of virtual direct supervision. So doctor, are you saying that you being away in Arkansas on vacation, duck hunting and being available if you happen to hear your phone, if there's a problem with the patient or they don't understand something or they're not sure about what needs to be prescribed, that this balances patient safety, quality, integrity of the program?
Are well, you that's why that- I have another physician in my physician directed clinic who's covering for me while I'm out under a reciprocal agreement. So,
but maybe you don't. What if you don't?
But if I don't, then you're spot on, Terry. Okay. And there's no argument.
There's no argument. I mean, listen, I agree. Yeah,
I'm sitting in a duck blind and I have an option to shoot a mallard or answer my phone about a patient who needs a clarification on prescription, I'm shooting the mallard.
Right. I'm in California. They're golfing out here. They're not duck hunting.
And listen, all those who are big PETA people, leave me alone. Okay. No, right. I don't have many vices in life that I actually get to enjoy because I've been married for almost 3 decades. And my wife has made certain that there's very limited things that I get to enjoy in life unless she gives a permission for it. So hunting birds is something that I enjoy. Okay. Oh, leave me alone. And so back to what we're I'm sure that's going to get played in front of a jury.
I'm sure it is. But our whole point here on the incident too, is that I know it sounds silly to even comment on this, but do what's right. Do what's appropriate for the circumstance. Make sure you're not taking these loopholes, if you will, these extensions, you know, especially based on your practice.
I think this was just stupid to extend it.
I agree. It should have been done the year that the PHE was done. Yeah.
If you want to do a study, don't tie it to COVID-19, which has been over now for a year plus. Okay. End the 1135 waivers the way that they were supposed to be ended, because some of this stuff is just garbage anyways. This just adds to the confusion and it creates more problems. And if you think prosecutors enjoy what we're talking about right now, they despise this conversation because it creates so much doubt in a juror's mind. If you get somebody like myself who's able to come in there and say, not so fast, my friend, look at what your own government did to extend the waivers, to extend virtual direct supervision. They hate this crap. Yeah. So
They only did it for political gain. They didn't do it for any other reason. It's not patient care. It's politics.
I believe that 100%. Listen, here's what I would say. And it's the thing that I've always said about Incident 2 from the very beginning. Incident 2 is a nightmare. It is the most complex of all of the provisional billing services. Listen, I have gone up against experts. I'm going up against experts this year who have opined on the fact that Incident 2 is really simple. Here's a one-page fact sheet from a Mac that spells it all out. Well, guess what? It's not as simple as a one-page FAQ from a Mac. If it was, why have we had so many prosecutions? Why have we had so many settlement agreements? Why have we had so many cases that were closed? Why is it that in 2017, the Office of Inspector General reached out to me to help them work through and develop the parameters for a study to ferret out fraud, waste, and abuse on Incident 2? It is not as simple as people want to make it out to be. And my recommendation is stop billing Incident 2. Get all of your daggum providers credentialed. Let them get the 85% of the 80% of the physician's allowed fee schedule, because that extra 15% that equates these days to adding cheese to a Happy Meal at McDonald's ain't worth it.
It isn't worth it. Well, and you have to know, you are talking to two subject matter experts on the topic. We have done our research. As I've mentioned before, I audit for payers, and one of the largest payers out there, we were talking about Incident 2. We were talking about all the published guidance. We went over it with a fine tooth comb. And then we sat in a room. I played Sean's daily dose from last year, beginning of last year. And it was a 20-minute clip just on Incident 2. I'm so glad you and I are both on the same page on Incident 2. And it was brilliant because it was just, this is how it works. You go outside of this, then you take your own, you know, your own risk on this.
Yeah.
And we're just telling you, this is how it works. So if you go back and find that, I don't remember what episode it was, Sean, but it was last year.
You know what? I'm going to tie it to this episode. And
it was really good.
Thank you for that. And I wish more women would say I was brilliant, because all the women in my life actually say, you're the smartest dumb guy I've ever met.
Well, Jill probably won't like the fact that I gave you so much kudos here. She's going to be like, Gary, what are you doing?
It's funny. For the first time, a guy actually said that to me. Now, granted, it was my brother-in-law. We were laughing about something this weekend, and he looked at me and goes, I swear to God, you're the smartest dumb guy I've ever met in my life. And I was like, how do I even take that? All right. So, yeah, again, Terry and I are we're in lockstep when it comes to Incident 2 services. What was actually funny was in the beginning, before we actually went live, she goes, oh, you know, there's one thing about Incident 2 that you and I disagree on. And I was like, we do? And she said it to me. And I was like, no, that's not me. I think you're thinking of somebody else. And she goes, oh, I think I am. Yeah, you were.
Yeah. So, and it was an attorney. We will not name him, but yeah, it was bad.
Or her.
Oh, yeah. Or her. Yeah.
Him or her. We are not going to narrow the field for anybody.
But we will tell you what it is. I'm going to just say it. Okay. Do not bill Incident 2 for new patient visits. Don't do it.
You can't.
You can't. No. And I don't care what they say. I don't care what you read. Oh, that brings up something. Uh-oh. If you don't think CMS or OIG or HHS aren't out there reading published, you know, blogs, they cite our blog. I was actually cited on an AI blog. AI was putting some information out and my site was cited. I was like, whoa. And then when I played your daily dose last year for, and I'll just put out there, United Healthcare. And we were talking about that. I said, let me find his article on it. I said, and here's my article. And they're like, wow, you guys are like mirrored. I go, but he, and it's funny because you're defense, I'm offense. I'm before they have to come see you. Yeah. And you're once that they could come knocking and they're like, hi, Sean. Hi, Mr. Weiss. Can you help me? I did this wrong. And I'm like, I'm before that happens. So when you have two people that are on the same page on this and the government entities, the payers are reading and referring to it. You probably should listen.
Because, no, that's a fair point because I've actually, you're right. Listen, I could show you a number of emails where I've literally received something from an attorney who was like, I have no idea who you are. And I wish I would have known prior to going into court on this case, because three or four things that you have talked about on a podcast or you have published as part of your blog or writings were actually used to convict my client. And I was like, well, you know, let's go back and really look at what it is that I wrote, because you just may not have understood how to defend it, because 80% of the things that I do is to help defend providers.
Well, I laugh when somebody says, what did somebody say the other day? And we'll probably end it on this one. This is funny to me. Somebody says, well, Terry, when you said, I go, when did I say this? Because it didn't sound familiar. And she's like, well, let me pull it up. Okay. So it was 1991. And I'm like, stop right there. I'm like, people, that's over 30 years ago. I'm like, what are you doing?
I was a junior in high school.
I might have said that in 91, but in 2024, we're, you know, move on. You know, she was talking about consults. And I'm just like, consults were, you know, not effective anymore, valid for Medicare in 2010. So, you know, you're kind of 20 years too late with your comment. Really. But look at current stuff. Look at anything within, I would say, a 24-month period. We've probably updated. That's why we revisit topics, because things change. Things fluid. We've got, you know, extensions and flexibilities and things that are temporarily and to a certain point. But then we say, okay, now this is what you have to do. So just in wrapping this up, this is really, we wanted to just really have you understand not just some of the things with Incident 2, but the virtual perspective of Incident 2, and really be cautioned about it. You know, don't invite risk. And if you've got that multiple physician practice with other doctors, have a doctor of the day. Put people on rotation. It just makes for a cleaner claim, better situation, and you don't have to then knock on Sean's door. That's all I'm
saying.
And
write a policy so that you don't say, well, we've always done it that way.
Or they said, they told us to do it this way. Who's they?
Who's they? Exactly. All right. That's going to bring us to the end of this episode. As always, a lot of fun, a lot of great information. Once again, we're in lockstep. One of these days, we're going to find something that we're not in lockstep, because I always enjoyed the bickering and banter.
People think we're related, that you're my brother.
Yeah, something like that, right? So, as always, thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out. Terry and I are going to be back next week with another great episode of The Compliance Guy, hashtag Terry Tuesday. I have a couple of great interviews coming up later this week. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.